check it out now. No doubt now.
Welcome to the Beating the Book podcast. Gil Alexander, it's our 85th Masters edition with Joe Pita and Brady Cannon. Just a warning, because we are here at Stadium Swim at Circus Sports and the music is blaring behind us, might have a few audio difficulties at some points in the podcast. We're going to do our best to edit around them. But the gist of the whole thing and all the bets will come shining through. But just a little bit of an apology in advance from all of us at the Beating the Book podcast. Enjoy. Welcome to the Beating the Book podcast, Masters edition, the 85th Masters, live from the pool at Circus Sports. It doesn't get any better than this. Gil Alexander along on site with Brady Cannon, host of Long Shots, the greatest golf betting show there ever was, at VSiN, which you will be hosting not only with your co-host Wes Reynolds today, but also with the great Scott Van Pelt.
Yeah, we're really excited about that. Scott Van Pelt will be our guest on Long Shots. Matt Eumanns will be in studio as well, so we'll have the full crew there. And couldn't really ask for a better guest. He's on the grounds at Augusta National.
Yes, he is. And he's SVP, for goodness sakes.
Right,
so we look forward to that. And we are also joined, and I do mean honored to be joined, by the guy who literally wrote the book on the Masters when it comes to data that is not public domain data like you can find in baseball, say, on a Fangraphs. It was the 2019 Masters Tour Guide for my good friend, once upon a time doing other sports, now completely focused on golf in his spare time. It's Joe Pita. How you doing, Joe?
Hey, guys. Brady and Gil, great to talk to you. And Brady, that's a great get in SVP. I know you guys know, but maybe some of the younger listeners don't. He was one of the, I don't know if he was the original or on the original crew, but a long ago, a near inception, Golf Channel host. So
yeah.
he certainly has the golf chops.
Yes, he was Golf Channel, I believe, right before ESPN.
That's, I think, like 1990 to 95 or something.
By the way, what year did you win the Masters?
85.
It was
before Jack turned the trick in 86. So I'm kind of the forgotten man.
No one remembers who won in 85.
Exactly.
That's a good year to pick. 85. maybe you remember that year.
Putting the jacket on Jack must have been a thrill for you.
That was really
right.
Even better than winning it. That was cool.
That's right. I should go back and check that footage, Brady.
Yeah.
Interesting. All right, Joe, I want to start with you because people who just heard what I said, they're like, what do you mean he wrote the book on the Masters? For those who didn't hear your appearances on A Numbers Game on VSiN when the book first came out in 2019, please explain to folks sort of the journey that led you to the 2019 Masters Tour Guide.
Yeah, Gil, after it was in early 2018 that I decided I was, that there was not as much written about golf analytics as there was about baseball. So I pivoted from baseball to golf. And when on the Masters site that year, I noticed, well, just to back up for a second, as you know, being analytics driven, strokes gained was the revolution in golf that and pioneered by Mark Brody, who uses the PGA's data to create the metrics that, golf analytics people use, whether you're DFS or a better or just a fan of the sport, that really helped change the way we looked at. It updated things from greens in regulation and putts per round. One of the limitations of it was if the event was not a PGA Tour event, like all of the majors at the, for a long time, there was no data. Here we love this data, but then the majors come and we couldn't use it. And it turns out that because the PGA Tour don't run those events, well, it turns out on the Masters site, I noticed in 2018 that there was a catalog of every shot taken. So I input them, all 20,000 plus shots I inputted after the 2018 event and wrote a book. Really Manually input, that's right. And kind of wrote a book previewing the 2019 event. And, really, so it was the first time that readers and golf fans in general got to see, how Patrick Reed won. Who was actually best tee to green at that event? And I've been doing it since. I since have been able to backfill a couple of other years, and I'm going to be having a larger book come out, hopefully pre-Christmas, that will really give the entire strokes gained history at the Masters, which will cover about 6 years. We'll cover 6 years, 16 to 21. So that's what I'm working on now. And that's how the first book got written.
Hey, Joe, real quick, for the viewers and the listeners, would you quickly explain exactly what is strokes gained? And greens in regulation, that's pretty obvious. You hit the green in regulation. But what is strokes gained really define for the statistician?
Sure. Well, as you know, Brady, and a lot of golf fans know, greens in regulation, like that sort of standard stat, can be highly misleading. You know, somebody that hits an iron shot from 180 to within 4 feet, on a second shot on a par five, say, and someone who, you know, hits their third shot on a par five, you know, chips it from 20 yards off the green and gets it to within 15 feet, they both have a green in regulation. But obviously, the former shot is much, much more valuable than the latter. So what greens and what strokes gain does is, thanks to the framework that Mark Brody created, it essentially takes every shot and judges it against a baseline of all other pros. And I always think the simplest way to sort of illustrate it is to think of an 8-foot putt. Most golf fans know that pros, touring pros, make 50% of their 8-foot putts. So if a pro is facing an 8-foot putt, it essentially has an expectation of 1.5 strokes, right? He's going to make it 50% of the time, and the other 50% of the time he'll 2-putt, because for these purposes, they never 3-putt from 8 feet. So if a golfer makes an 8-foot putt, he has picked up a half stroke, or he has gained a half stroke against the benchmark of the field. And if he 2-putts from 8 feet, he's lost a half stroke. And you essentially do that with every stroke. You can benchmark every drive, every approach, and every putt. You sum them all up in the end. And that's now you have a much more granular, and to me, because I like data to tell stories, you get a much better story of what happened during a round. And, you know, by the time you put a number of rounds together, a number of tournaments together, now you have stories on each golfer's skill sets and how they differ. And as you know, Brady, different tournaments reward different skills. So it's a very useful tool. And I just think it's fascinating and fun.
This gives us entree, by the way, before we get to our specific Masters thoughts for this year, 2021. Probably the greatest thing in your Masters tour guide was in doing this research on strokes gained analysis specifically for the Masters. You stumbled upon maybe the greatest single stat in modern golf history, and we're not even sure to this day if the person who is at the center of this stat and of this streak is aware of it. Could you explain to people what that is?
Sure, and I will tell you, before I publish this December, I will try to reach out to this person in question and get his thoughts on it. We're, of course, referring to Tiger Woods. And strokes gained is...
Are you familiar
really
with this, by the way?
I read the book, and I'm sure I'll remember it.
Okay.
When he...
All right, go ahead. I'm sorry, Joe.
Yeah. So even pro golfers, I think it was maybe Stuart Sink who referred to strokes gained as a cruel mistress. You know, it is a brutal machine, because you are always being judged against your fellow pros. So if you shoot a 3 under 69, you know, on a course, but the field shoots 68.5, you have actually lost a half stroke to the field. So picking up positive strokes gained each round is an accomplishment. Now, for the most elite players, they expect to do it. But, you know, you know, somebody goes 68, 68, 73, 68, you know, even if they're Rory, that 73 round probably lost strokes to the field. Well, it turns out Tiger Woods went an entire 365-day period plus without a round losing strokes to the field.
Wow.
And he was within one. The punchline of the story is, in the year 2000, he was within one hole, you know, one round and one hole, the 18th hole of his final round of the year. And he to put together what I call the perfect year, the perfect PGA Tour season. And he missed it. And our friend Chris Felica actually called in, and I couldn't find the scorecard. And when we first told this story, he called in and showed us that Tiger actually went like double-double at Valderrama in Spain at a World Golf Championship event to end the 2000 season. And it broke his it was over 90 rounds that he'd had of strokes gained on the field. And to me, it's even more impressive than his 140-plus made cuts in a row, because to make cuts, to make that many cuts in a row, it essentially means you never had a bad round on Thursday or Friday. To go 90 rounds in a row without, you know, picking up strokes on the field essentially means you never had a blow-up hole for 90-some rounds. Because, you know, you go, you put a triple on the card, it is now very hard to gain strokes on the field for a round. And he did it for, and I think that's the most, and what you start, when you start going through data, you realize that at any time a golfer gets to 20 rounds, it's an amazing accomplishment. You know, and Tiger got up to 90. I think the second highest is something like Marco Mira at 30 or 31, you know, something like that. And it's just, it'll never be broken.
Joe, you probably remember, it was, I believe, last year on tour, it was a big deal because Victor Hovland led the field in strokes gained tee to green for 3 weeks in a row.
Right.
And that was monumental.
That's right.
Three weeks in a row.
That's right.
So yeah. Interestingly, that did not make the Tiger documentary, Joe. I was waiting for it the whole time when I was watching. I was like, when is the strokes game thing coming up? All right, guys. So the 85th version of the Masters, it is the one of our majors, of our four majors, where we actually play on the same course.
Right.
We talk about this, obviously, every year. This year's a little different because we're coming off the pandemic Masters, which was played in November. Very different. Dustin Johnson with a 20 under. We obviously never see scores like that at the Masters. And Cameron Smith, famously the first guy to ever have four rounds in the 60s. Now, I guess the first question is, how much do we read into that November version of the Masters, Brady, which had a weather situation at the beginning, which softened the course? So it's interesting hearing people, because some people are like, ah, you throw it out. It meant nothing. On the other hand, the golfers who did well kind of have good history on the course, too. So
in some respects,
it does matter. Where do you fall on it?
Yeah, it's a little bit in between. I don't think you throw it out completely, but there's some interesting handicapping angles around it. First of all, I think what you saw was a lot of guys that were debutants at the Masters. We know that debutants, the first-timers, typically don't have a great deal of success. And you saw a lot of guys, a lot of those guys have success in November. And I think a lot of that had to do with the softer conditions. Of course, DJ goes to 20 under par, breaks an all-time record. So there were some situations that were outside of the norm. But then you mentioned some cream did rise to the top like it usually does at Augusta. It's usually a chalky tournament. The best players do typically end up on the back nine on Sunday atop the leaderboard. And from the scoring statistics, it wasn't all that different from a normal April Masters. It was lower across the board, but not by as much as you might think. I think the biggest difference for me was seeing guys like Sebastian Munoz, Cameron Smith, Sungjae Im. Now, Smith has been there a few times, but Im a first-timer. Scottie Scheffler a first-timer. CT Pan, Corey Connors. Whoa. These guys were all in the top 20. So I think that is different. I don't think you're going to see that again. Another thing that I think is interesting, I wonder what your opinion on this is, Joe. Guys that did play the Masters for the first time in November, it's almost a disadvantage to be back here this year because I think they've got a rude awakening to what they're going to find in April.
Yeah, I agree with you. You the one name we all kind of, I think we all as fans of the Masters, you know, have some sort of sense of guardianship that we don't want to see the CT Pans as debutantes. And you didn't throw out the name, but Dylan Fratelli.
Right.
I take offense if these guys are going to be in the top 10. You know, if they're going to be clustered in the top 10. We had Abraham, you know, short hitting Abraham answer there as well until he blew up on Sunday. So I agree with you. And I think they are going to be in for a rude awakening this year. And to throw just one more, you know, sort of proprietary stat out there that dovetails exactly with what Brady said and Gil, is that the year-over-year correlation of strokes gained, you know, individual golfer strokes gained from one year to the next is always higher at the Masters than any other tournament. It's not even close. It usually averages, you know, above 0.3, and no other tournament gets above the high teens. Well, the correlation from the prior April in 2019 to the 2020 November was 0.3. So it was, you know, it's right what you'd expect. So I agree, you can't throw it all out.
Yeah.
Because, and I'll just throw one other, we'll mention a big name here. If you are inclined to say, I'm going to throw it out, right? That, you know, is that anything that happened I'm not going to believe in? I would point this out to you. Justin Thomas has been an abysmal putter at the Masters. He's been negative strokes gained every year, 16 through 19. And with some, you know, and if you look at it by round, you know, it's a large majority are negative rounds. In 2020, in November, he gained over three strokes putting. It was the first time he's ever been positive. And as we know, he finished, but he got a top five last year. Fourth, okay. Now, if you're going to throw out November, you know, then don't you have to throw out, you know, you got to throw it all out, right? It was the first time that Justin Thomas has ever successfully putted the mass, you know, the greens at Augusta National. So that's just what I like to point out to people. If it's not so easy to just say, I'm going to ignore it, because then you have to ignore all of it.
It's like there were a lot of differences when you look at the leaderboard and everything, but grand picture, like Joe says, the scoring was pretty darn similar.
That's pretty fascinating. I'm gonna go to the phone here, guys. Steve the punter, you're familiar with Stephen Rawlings. Every year he puts together some nice master stats. And again, if you've heard this in past years, there's a reason for it, because again, we're playing on the same course. Driving accuracy, the least important thing to eventual Masters winners. If you go back the last 12, the average rank in driving accuracy for the winners was damn near 30th, 29th.17. Driving distance, average rank of the past 12 winners, 18.5. The categories that matter the most, greens and regulation, per Stephen Rawlings, 6.66 in the rankings. Scrambling, 9.8. So really, getting up and down is everything at Augusta. Putting average, 11th. The other big thing that we always talk about, where do winners and where do people who are successful at the Masters make their hay? Well, let's go back 12 years again. Par threes, aggregate for the last 12 winners, 13 under par on par threes. On par fours, 27 under. On the par fives, 107 under.
Yep.
So it is really all about the par fives. Before you guys give your picks and how you're betting it, how you allocate your money in outrights and derivative markets and head-to-heads, let me just cherry-pick a few golfers and get your opinion on what you feel about these guys. Let's do Brooks Koepka and Daniel Berger, who are both headed in with injury concerns. Brooks Koepka, I got 30-1. I heard you got a 40-1 on Brooks Koepka.
Yes.
So you took a flyer as well,
because. Well, it's Brooks Koepka, and I also noticed you start with two Florida State Seminoles there.
I did not notice that.
But, I had actually been thinking. I had six guys in my outright portfolio, and I was trying to think. There's one more guy I want, and I want to take a little bit of a shorter shot, because we mentioned earlier, this is a pretty chalky tournament. You typically don't have a triple-digit long shot win this thing. In fact, I think it was the last 11 winners, the average pre-tournament odds were less than 40-1. So I think that's kind of the threshold there.
Yeah.
You don't want to do a whole lot outside of 40-1. But Koepka was the guy I was thinking about adding a while back, and before he withdrew from the Honda, and I think it was Bay Hill or the Workday, or he finished actually second at the Workday, but took the time off, had knee surgery, exactly what will be 23 days prior to teeing off at Augusta. So it is a gamble because we don't know about his health, but I said, if Brooks Koepka is telling me, and he said, I'm not entering because I think I can finish second. If he thinks he can win, I'm going to take his word at it. And at 40-1, that's three or four times the normal price we see on Brooks Koepka. So, yes, I took a stab with that. As far as Daniel Berger, I think he's got a good shot, too. He is such an expert at putting on Bermuda grass. And I don't know if he's quite figured out the bent grass yet. He's had one tremendous finish. I believe it was his first year playing the Masters. I believe had a top 10 finish. Guy's a great player, and I absolutely love him as a Ryder Cupper. He's not on my list to win the Masters.
Not on mine either. Joe, curious about those two guys, and I'll throw in one. Go ahead with those two.
We're talking about two guys that have never missed a cut at Augusta there. Berger 3-for-3 and Koepka 5-for-5. That doesn't necessarily mean they're a horse for the course. As I always say, you got to look at the numbers a little deeper. But both of them shine in their histories here. And it, Berger, I have, is a top 10. And I think he is a threat he's not going to pull away from the field. But in a bunched field like we had 2 years ago when Tiger would, a Daniel Berger skill set is definitely, he has a path to victory. I have him as a top 10 bet. With Brooks Koepka, look, I've got to make the cut somewhere, right? Because there's so many elite guys. You're absolutely right. If Brooks Koepka is healthy, 40-1 is a steal in terms of implied odds versus actual odds. But I just made the choice that I was going to figure he's hobbled in some way, either in rust or from an actual injury. He's one of the best golfers in the world, and he's played outstanding in all five of his, all five of his efforts here. He has an adjustment. He plays almost a half stroke better per round at the Masters than he does during those same tournaments before and after the Masters. So he's definitely a horse for the course. But like I say, I'm omitting him just because I have to make some cuts somewhere.
He was in great form before he pulled out with injury too. Finished second at the Concession and won the Phoenix Open.
Joe, about you do have to draw the line somewhere, because otherwise,
you've got 20 guys.
Brian Rogers just came up here. He was your stand-in here, or your sit-in, and he said, "I have 29 bets already."
Oh, okay.
Not 29 different golfers, right. But upwards of like 15 to 20 already. So
it's Masters.
It's like you can go crazy in this. All right, last golfer before I let you get to it, Jordan Spieth, who just came off a win at the Valero Texas Open, who has had, obviously, already has a green jacket, has had great success on this course. How do you view someone who is now all the way down to 11-1 in the group of the elite, the Rahms and the JTs and the DeChambeaus of the world? Do you just completely stay away from him, Joe?
Well, let me take on one hand and on the other hand. On one hand, Jordan Spieth is even better than Tiger and Phil in terms of history at the Masters. Now, obviously, that's only 28 rounds in his case, and we're getting in the upper double digits for Phil and Tiger when you talk about their histories. But Jordan Spieth has entered 7 times. He's played 28 rounds here, and he has averaged more strokes gained per round than any player who's ever played, at least in this era. I think with last year's slight slump, he fell behind Ben Hogan in terms of career. But he's up there in terms of the greatest Masters players per round in the history of the event. So, and it makes sense because, as you talked about earlier, it is a second course. It is a second shot course. And he has been a wizard with the irons, at least since I've been able to measure his strokes gained since 16. And he can get hot with a putter, as we all know. So there is a case that if he is in 14, 15, 16 Jordan Spieth form, he should be a top. On the other hand, he has been hot for 3 months, so he has a nice, sort of form for the last 20 rounds. But if you pull that lens back to even just 40 rounds or 50, you would say, hey, there's a lot of guys that have come in winning the Houston Open and having looked 10 or 11-1. I think that's an insanely short price. So, yes, I'm certainly staying away from him.
You too?
I am too. Yeah, the price is absolutely prohibitive. Now, when he shot 61 at the Phoenix Open, you still could have gotten him at 50-1, and I'd love to have that ticket in my pocket. And Joe, you talk about his iron play. It's probably the first time in 3 years and 7 months, that's when he last won the British Open at Royal Birkdale, that he, and you mentioned this 3 month period that he's been so hot, he's actually been finally gaining strokes with his irons once again. He hasn't done that basically since he's gotten on this roll. So that's a great sign for Jordan Spieth, but no, I can't bet him, and because the price absolutely is keeping me out.
Before we get into Joe and Brady's individual bets on the Masters, first, guys, question about allocation of your funds. What percentage of your betting pie is on outrights? What percentage is on derivative markets like top 10s and top 20s? What percentage would you say is on head-to-heads?
Yeah, I'll step up. I will tell you I have more in the outright market. So for me, the outright market will be, in terms of actual capital laid out, I will have more than 10% of what I'm going to bet on this overall on the outrights, which is more than any other event. One is because it's fun. But two is, Gil, I'm telling you, where you're sitting, what the Circa is doing to revolutionize or to make attractive futures betting on a big event like this by lowering that hold,
yes,
is, man, if it catches on across the industry, they are going to realize that lower margins leads to higher handle and ultimately a better bottom line, even though it takes more skill to manage the book. Obviously, Circa knows this, and I just cannot give those guys a big enough compliment for pushing the industry in that direction. As you know, Gil, I tried to get on that side of the industry and actually operate one of these, and this was the exact, you know, sort of business model I had. So,
yeah.
Kudos to them, and I think it hopefully it will lead to more of what you call the pre-flop. And you mentioned about in-game. I am not betting Justin Thomas pre-flop because of his putting, you know, April putting woes at the Masters. It's Justin Thomas. If he is lurking after Thursday and Friday and he's showing me that the putting is carrying over from November, he's the one guy I'm kind of targeting in game.
So let me follow up on that.
Yep.
What would it give me the parameters of that? So let's just throw out some hypotheticals. If JT were six strokes back, because this famously is not a catch-up course either, right? So let's say it's let me not make it six. Let me make it harder. Let's say it's five strokes back, and he balloons to 40-1. That is somewhere in that sort of range. Like, what would it take for
we're
you
talking
not
after
to make
round one or after yeah,
after
round
one
or round three?
Let's say after round one.
Well, here would be my demarcation point. Is he positive strokes gained putting or not? You know, if he got to where he did by chipping something in, or, you know, he just dialed in with the irons, but still two putting from 11 feet consistently, it's not a bet for me. But if he's showing me that he has sort of mastered these greens, then I think he does have a Jordan Spieth 2018 type comeback, even though that was a near comeback. But remember, he almost ran down Patrick Reed in 2018. And Justin Thomas can do that against any front runner on any course, if he can show me he's putting these greens.
And then the derivative markets like top 10, top 20, and the head-to-heads, is that like even between the two of those categories?
Well, no, much, much more on head-to-heads, Gil, because that's where the hold is it's not a dime line, but it's still, it's much more pure, right? It's a head-to-head matchup in terms of how I'm handicapping guys. And it's just playing with the standard minus 110 line. I almost never do top. I never do first round leaders because the hold is insane. I never do three balls for the same reason. But the on top tens, look, I publish a top 10 every year for the Masters. So I do bet this every year. And I will, I'll put all my top 10 plays in there. But as always, I always consider all that other stuff entertainment. I believe I have positive EV on my matchup bets. I don't necessarily think that when I'm having fun doing futures and, top 10 stuff.
Makes sense. How about you?
Yeah, I'll probably have about maybe, let's say, 30% of my outlay in the outright markets. And then, probably 50% will be in the top 10, and I'm doing the math wrong here, but I'll have the smallest portion in the outright market, and I'll probably have about 1.5 times that risk on the top 20 and the top 10s, and then the rest, the largest portion of my pie will be on head-to-head matchups. That's where I'm going to risk the most dollars.
For the tournament, not round by round.
Correct. I am not good at round-to-round head-to-head matchups. I'm much more successful on the full tournament, and I think I'm just better at figuring out how a guy's skill set is going to manifest over 4 days. It's kind of like trying to bet a football game for one quarter. Anything can happen in one round of golf. So I have been very good in head-to-head matchups for the entire tournament, and that's where my biggest risk will be. Joe, you talk about the top 10s and the top 20s. I have kind of started to gravitate more towards the top 20. Obviously, you're getting a lower price, but you double your ability to win. And I have found that those are good bets. I like the top 20 market a lot. Now, you get a low-priced guy like Justin Thomas, I might go top 10 with him. But other than my shortest shots, I'll probably go top 20 with. And then I
how many times have you had guys finish 12th when you do a top 10?
Exactly. Yeah. That's the tough part. So I've had plenty finish 22nd, too.
Yeah.
But I like that top 20 market. I think I do better than the top 10. And then the outrights, I have 7 of them and on my least amount of risk.
Let's start there. It is that time. Who have you bet outright?
So, and we've talked about this. The Masters is kind of a chalky tournament. I took 2 flyers on guys that I think have a puncher's chance, but at the time that I bet them, their numbers were so much of an outlier versus the rest of the market, I said, I got to try it. And that was Jason Kokrak, and I got him at 170-1. Now, he's kind of come back. When I got it, everywhere else had him at 100, and I got him at 170. Now, he's probably in the neighborhood of 150. The other guy, and I think he does have a shot. He has some things that make sense. He's been in good form. He won at Shadow Creek, which I think is a correlated course. The other guy is Francesco Molinari. Now, he hasn't been in great form. He started to return to form a little bit in 2021. Obviously, he was there on Sunday with Tiger before
he
put the ball in the water. Got him at 125. Now, he has started to drift up back towards that neighborhood. But again, when I bought him, a lot of people were trading him at 75-1.
Yeah.
So those were my 2 long shots. And then the rest of the guys, I think, are substantial bets that really have a good chance to win this thing. I did go with Justin Thomas, Joe. And what I love about Justin Thomas is my first bet on him was at plus 1525. And then when he cratered in a tournament recently. It was before he won the Players, and he drifted up to 19-1. So I bought more at 19-1 on Justin Thomas. Definitely like that number. That's long gone at this point after he won the Players. I did take Koepka at 40-1. I took Patrick Cantlay, who I got at 30-1, which was a nice number. He's down closer to 22 or what have you at this point. And Matthew Fitzpatrick, I got him a while ago at 100-1. He's now down to about 40-1. So
nice prices.
There's my card. Louis Oosthuizen. Louis Oosthuizen, I got at 75-1, and he's still in that neighborhood.
Joseph?
Yeah, those last 2 names you mentioned are favorites of mine way up the boards. I will try to play them in all matchups that I can in Fitzpatrick and Oosthuizen. I think that because both of them, well, Oosthuizen has always played very well here. He is very good tee to green here. Obviously he's getting up in age, but I do like that thought. I think for a guy that far up the board, I think his outrights are undervalued, so I will try to take advantage of that elsewhere. Same with Fitzpatrick, and with the other guy a little closer down the range is Cam Smith. He did not come out of nowhere last year at Augusta. That was his 4th trip here, and he'd actually had a very solid strokes gained history on his 12 rounds before the 4 last year. So he is also an outright play of mine. But the series, because those odds are so high, you don't have to put a lot of capital down to get some sort of payoff. The guys, though, that I'm really serious about up in the elite section, and it is a chalky tournament. I haven't always done that. Gil, as you know, 2 years ago, I wrote a whole book.
Yes.
Explaining, coming to the conclusion that Tony Finau was going to win the Masters. And obviously that was a thrilling, Saturday for me. And the last day, I was the only person in America probably not rooting for Tiger on Sunday.
Yes.
But it is more chalky this year. Finau still definitely has the tee to green game. It's only gotten, it's only stayed strong at Augusta, but, the putting and really the volatility, the volatility isn't there in his game to get to the plus 14, plus 16 strokes gain that you need to win a tournament. And, I've gotten burned enough times having him in a top 5, and not breaking through. So I am a chalky with my 2 favorite plays. They are John Rahm and Xander Schauffele out of the sort of elite group. Neither of them are they're better prices than you get from DJ or Thomas or Spieth. I really think Rahm should be favored to win this tournament, honestly. And that is how I'm playing it. And I have I have put a substantial, in terms of the what I'm putting in the outrights, almost, the biggest majority of it goes to Rahm. I'm not really sprinkling. This isn't really a sprinkle situation as much as I think Rahm should be favored. And if I'm getting him at 11, 13, I've seen him at 14. It was 14 and a quarter at the Circa when they posted just two nights ago. I think that's my play. And I think Xander Schauffele also has the course history here. And in current form and intermediate form to be a real factor. I will say way up the board, way, way, way up the board at Circa, Justin Rose is 130-1. Justin Rose, except for missing the cut in 2018 or 2019, he has played superbly here. I cannot get my hands around a world where Justin Rose is 130-1 at Augusta, or at least at Circa. Now, most of your other books, you're going to get 50, 60-1, et cetera. But
I've seen I've seen a lot of hundreds.
I would not hesitate. If I were just walking through the casino and saw that, I would take out at least 50 bucks and just throw it down, you know, at 130-1. And because that to me just looks interesting. And maybe he's hurt. Maybe the equipment is still causing him problems, but it's that one really opened my eyes.
I bet Koepka, just like you, on a flyer, just in case. Cameron Smith, and then I went super chalky at the top two. I went John Rahm, Justin Thomas, and fifth and final, Bryson DeChambeau, which is a self-loathing prevention bet, which is what I want to ask you guys about. Who's the one guy that you don't have a preflop bet on who, if he wins it, will cause you the most self-loathing? Joe, would it be Tony Finau then, I guess, would be answer to yours?
Although I would be so happy for him.
Yes.
Normally it would be Jason Day. Jason Day is on my do not trade list because of how many times I have gotten either screwed by him both ways, either betting on him or not betting on him. You know, the most famous in my case being, I think I had him at the Arnold Palmer, and I had him like loaded in DFS and in matchup bets. And he left the course after the fifth hole. Instead, you know, if he had not teed off, everything would have been refunded.
Yeah.
He left the course after the fifth hole and then was seen at Disneyland with his at Disney World with his family in the afternoon.
Yes.
And yes, that was so he sort of fits that. I think Gil, this week, though, it would be Rory because he's so damn good. And I haven't even considered betting on him. And because I'm just saying, hey, he's not Rory anymore because of the last 9 months. And that might be foolish. It might be foolish having written him off. And I would be chagrined if he won like wire to wire.
I'm right with you. I even said on the radio on a numbers game on VSiN this morning that if I were to find a make-miss cut market, I would love to see what the price is on Rory. I was told after the show by someone who tweeted in, forgive me for not knowing who it was, that the no is 4-1. I could kind of see myself maybe taking a flyer on that. Rory's telling us he's not playing well. He's made good on that promise so far in recent weeks. So that's one guy I would consider there, too. So I'd be right in the same boat with you.
I'm with you, though, Joe. If Rory were to go on to win, it was kind of like Brooks Koepka when he won at Phoenix, where I think his odds were in the neighborhood of 30-1. And it's, you know, I'm trying to correct myself for my past mistake and bet on him this time when he was 40-1. There were a lot of people that had Brooks Koepka at the Phoenix, and they said, when do you get Brooks Koepka at 30+1 or whatever? It's kind of the same thing with Rory here. We've seen him as high as 19-1. Maybe he'll go to 20. That's a really big number on Rory McIlroy. So we'll all be kicking ourselves if we say, geez, why didn't we grab 20-1 on one of the greatest players of all time?
For sure.
Yeah, and it's not just all time. If you look at, he is the best driver of the golf ball at Augusta since 2016. And the only person who was in his realm is Bubba Watson. So without question, Rory is the best right-handed driver of the golf ball in this generation at Augusta. The numbers he puts up strokes gained-wise driving is incredible. So yeah, he gets that advantage off the tee. I'm overlooking the guy who very possibly is going to be in better position standing over a second shot than everyone else as the tournament goes on. But we'll see.
Wasn't it it was November too, where I think he finished top 10 and in the opening round, he shot a 75.
Yeah.
So yeah, he found his game for three out of the four rounds, for sure.
I assume that neither of you, maybe I shouldn't assume this, we're doing this Tuesday afternoon right here at the Circa Pool, obviously, the Masters more than 36 hours away. But so I'm going to assume that you don't have any head-to-heads yet in your accounts.
I did play two today.
I do.
You do. Okay.
Go ahead, Joe.
Let me not assume that. Go ahead, Joe. What do you got?
Yeah, I have a number of them, but I will tell you my favorite one. And I have noticed now that it's not like there's a Vegas rotation around matchups that different books having play different matchups. But I got Ian Poulter versus Phil Mickelson and it became my largest matchup bet. I kind of went 2x on that versus what I was putting on everybody else. And I'll go ahead. Oh, yeah, there it is. I got a Poulter minus 130 versus Phil Mickelson over four rounds. I mean, look, unless Phil is pulling magic, and by the way, his putting has disintegrated at the Masters as his age has gone on. Ian Poulter has a great history on this course, and he's just a better golfer now than Phil Mickelson, and that's no slight at Phil, but he just can't consistently put together 18 holes, let alone 72. I salivated at minus 130 on Ian Poulter.
And Ian Poulter just coming off a great performance at the match play in Austin.
Yeah.
And Phil, when we talk about public teams and other sports, Phil's about as public as it gets
at golf. Yeah, and I think that kind of ties into Joe's bet here that you're probably getting a really good price on Ian Poulter because the other guy is Phil Mickelson.
Yeah. So you're not finding those matchups universal from book to book this time around?
You know, somebody was telling me last night, they're like, hey, you know, we mentioned golfers that might be, for instance, you were talking about Fitzpatrick and, or maybe it was Cam Smith and, you know, guys that I like, but their only matchup market for my guy, the books I was looking at, was against Webb Simpson, who I also kind of think is undervalued. So it's not that's not how I want to express bullishness on Cam Smith or Fitzpatrick. And then one guy was telling me, oh, at my book, he's matched up with five different guys. And I'm like, these are either offline or, you know, paper heads, et cetera. So it just, and sometimes people quote me stuff and I'm like, I can't find that for my guys. So.
Yeah. There's kind of one universal set of matchups. Then there's like half a dozen others. Huh. So it is kind of a crapshoot finding.
Care to share the other one that you had besides Poulter over Phil?
Oh, that was the one, Gil, that was the one that I put the 2X on.
Okay.
There was one other one that I did a 1.5X. Let me...
we find, like 1.5X.
I put the Joaquin Niemann, also Joaquin Niemann minus 150 over Max Homa. Mm. And this sort of goes to Brady's thing about the debutantes I think Niemann, look, Max Homa is a great story. California kid and the winning at Riv was amazing. That was obviously his life goal. I think it's a step up in class here and Joaquin Niemann is in much better form over the last, 6 months when you look at a round per round basis than, even though he doesn't have the win that, sort of the high profile win that Homa does.
Yep. I'm with you.
Niemann has played here. Niemann played here as an amateur, I think it was 3 years ago, or 2 or 3 years ago, and made the cut.
By the way, all debutante mention unders cashed when you said it early in the podcast. less
Very
than 5 minutes in. What did you bet
head-to-head? I am on Joaquin Niemann as well. I was hoping Joe gravitated towards the same one, but I took Joaquin Niemann minus 130 over Abraham Answer. And Joe talked about how Abraham Answer had a great showing and then fell off the pace. And I think maybe he's possibly a victim of the November conditions. He might find a much different complex here with the drier, faster, firmer conditions. And you talked about Niemann, Joe. Niemann is a phenomenal player. And look what he did earlier the year. I think he was minus 46 under par for the two Hawaii tournaments and didn't win. I also think there's some correlation between Kapalua, where he came in second, to Augusta National. Niemann is a guy I might do a top 20 bet on as well, but like him in that head-to-head over Abraham Answer. And then two guys, Joe, I wonder what your opinion on this one is. I took Danny Berger at minus 135 over Cam Smith.
Oh.
See, that's another example of where I think both the guys are relatively undervalued in terms of their, just odds in general. I do like Berger. I mean, I've got Berger in a top 10 bet, and you know, I'm looking at my neutral ranking since the restart. Daniel Berger, and this is adjusted for field strength, is number 6 in terms of strokes gained per round, and the 5 guys ahead of him, in order, JT, Dustin Johnson, Bryson, Xander, and John Rahm. And so Berger is in rarefied company up there in terms of who has played best on a per round basis since the restart. And he's got a nice history here. He has a path to victory.
Okay. First of all, there's a whole cross section of our audience that appreciates you betting Berger.
Yes.
I won't say who, but we appreciate it. You know what I mean? And then finally, guys, then top 10s, top 20s, I guess you're some of the guys that you've been outright in some of your matchups, you just sort of funnel into those?
Probably not everyone. I think Jason Kokrak I might find a spot for in a top 20. Probably Fitzpatrick as well. I think JT I'll take with a top 10. I'll probably stay away from Koepka. You know, that's a gamble of a play.
I agree with that.
And if it's the right gamble, he's going to be in the mix.
Yep.
But I'm not going to mess around with probably any more investment on him. Cantley, I'll probably do for a top 20 as well. I haven't quite dived into that market head first just yet.
Same with you, Joe?
Yeah, exactly. The only guy that is in my, that I have a top 10 on that we hadn't talked about before is Cantley. I will look, guys, at the top 20s. I am going to look exclusively for higher price guys that have a nice course history, who maybe haven't played well over the last year because of age. So we're talking about here a Matt Kuchar. Mm-hmm. Like I said, Justin Rose earlier, Oosthuizen, Adam Scott, all these guys have Hideki Matsuyama, who used to be a stalwart in my top 10 bets the last 2 years. These are guys that have very nice histories here that I think might make some attractive top 20 bets.
I love it. Guys, I can't thank you enough. Can't thank the people at Circus Sports. Enough, Derek Stevens, Mike Palm, Stadium Swim. What a backdrop we have here!
It's lousy out here.
This
isn't it?
Is terrible. Joe, you should never come here. It's awful.
Sorry about the weather.
Joe, appreciate it, man. Joe Pete, everybody at Magic Rat SF on Twitter. It's a Bruce Springsteen nod on his Twitter handle. Where can people get the 2019 tour guide, which is still very applicable, and where can they find anything you will be doing in the future?
Yeah, the tour guide, the 2019 event, which does give some nice master stories and background on the strokes gained, is still at Amazon. And hopefully, I'm aiming for a hardcover book that'll really be a tome on the Masters in the strokes gained era. You know, we'll look out for that, but the goal is pre-Christmas publication for all those fathers, sons, you know, stocking stuff.
Pre-Christmas 2021, we're talking.
That's right.
Wow. Love it. Joe Pete, everybody. Joe, thank you so much. Brady Cannon, host of Long Shots, the greatest golf betting show there ever has been on earth at VSiN, which he does with Wes Reynolds and Matt Eumanns, and the podcast version of Long Shots, in addition, with SVP on both this time around, this
yep.
week.
Going to be great. Thank you very much for having me. An honor to be with you two guys. Joe, have admired your work for a long time. Thanks for stopping by, man.
Thank you, Joe. Appreciate it.
Hey, guys. I'm half vaxxed. I will be fully vaxxed and maybe out there for the PGA or the U.S. Open, and we'll certainly say hi.
Yes, half vaxxed. I am fully vaxxed.
I'm half vaxxed.
Both of you. So thank you all. 85th Masters.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks for listening. Good luck with all your bets from all of us on the Beating the Book podcast. Enjoy.